This is Christopher, and I want to welcome you to the Time Shifters Podcast. This podcast takes a fun look at the films of long past, recent past, and the almost present, as well as the events and news surrounding them. Matt and I would love to hear from you, and there are several ways to get in touch with us. Look for the Time Shifters Podcast group on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm at Time Shifters Pod, and Matt is at Movies at the Matt. And you can send us a typed or recorded message to timeshifterspodcast@gmail.com. If you haven't already, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher Radio, and Spotify. Please rate and review the show at any of those outlets. Now, let's head to the Time Shifter studio and start the show. Everyone, welcome back. Matt and I are here in studio. Matt and I are here in studio. Try to get that out properly. Matt, how are you?
Good.
I hope you had a good Thanksgiving. This is the first episode we're recording after the holiday.
Yeah.
I got the last episode out a little early because it would normally have dropped on Thanksgiving. I'm like, well, no one's going to be there. So I'll, you know, if people are traveling, they'll give them something to listen to. So
I come around the table. We're putting on Time Shifters.
Yeah. So this one will go out on our regular drop. But and I think this will be the episode. Yeah, this will be the episode that drops before Christmas. Christmas falls in between our episodes, so I hope everyone enjoys their Christmas holiday. We will have an episode drop before the New Year, so we'll deal with that next time.
Hmm.
News and stuff. There was something I wanted to bring it up, and I was hoping you would watch it, but apparently you had not. I was wondering if you saw the Xfinity commercial with Henry Thomas and E.T.
I saw everybody talking about it, but I hate commercials in all their forms. I am the kind of person that, like, if I'm watching Hulu and a commercial comes on, I immediately go do something else. Or if I can, I'll find ways to, like, skip the commercials if I'm watching it on, like, some other app. I'll be like, okay, I can play this and go do something for an hour, and then all the commercials will have been watched, and then I can come back and watch it without the commercials.
Oh, right.
I will plan my day like that to avoid commercials. If I go to watch, like, it's like it's a minute and a half clip. This funny dog did something, and it's like you have 10 seconds of commercial. But like it's not going to be that funny. No, I don't even skip. Like when you can't skip the commercial, I'm like, no, I'm not going to see the video.
Okay,
I don't know what it is. I'm just a spoiled millennial, I guess.
Okay, it's a shame because I was really curious to hear what you like. Because I thought this 3-minute commercial, granted,
God,
it is a commercial,
that sounds awful.
But this 3-minute commercial does more for me than most movies I go and see.
That's what I heard. I was like, cool, maybe like I will get to a funny commercial or an interesting commercial when it no longer has any advertising value, right. So I'll see it in 5 years.
Well, I'll say it this way. I'll sell it to you this way. I was really surprised that it is supposed to be a commercial for Xfinity, what are they, cable or satellite, I don't know, you know, or in internet or whatever. But it's really subtle. No, at no point does anyone, let's use our Xfinity. You just see them using the product, but they never like name check it or anything. Okay. It is really about, it's just this kind of like heartwarming story.
ET came back.
Yeah. And it just so happens that they watch TV and they have Xfinity, you know.
It makes me wonder if like that was like a soft test to, hey, should we reboot ET? Like, is Xfinity maybe going to be like a producer in there?
I'll say this. It was probably a better ET sequel than the planned sequel would have been. If you've ever read what they planned to do with a sequel for ET, it was like dark and aliens trying to take over the planet kind of thing. And I'm like, where the hell did that come from? So, yeah, this is a better sequel than that would have been.
But if in the next like 6 months to a year you hear they're going to do an ET movie and it's all those years later, you know why.
You know why.
Because
yeah.
You all watch the commercial.
But anyway, that's the only thing I had that I wanted to bring up.
So I came across an article that was talking about the future of the DC comic movies and how several of the ones that are coming out are going to get R ratings.
Wow.
So the Birds of Prey movie is probably going to be rated R. The Suicide Squad is probably going to be rated R. And that they're heading more in that R rating, darker kind of realm with their movies. And, you know, I don't think every single DC movie needs an R rating. Big part of it is because the Joker did so well.
Right.
And that has had an R rating. And now I think it's like the highest grossing R rated movie of all time. Broke $1 billion, which I did not see coming. I figured it would top out around 700 million.
No.
When I heard it was like at 950, I was like, okay, this is definitely breaking a billion. This is insane. But now it's like, okay, you know what? Not every DC movie needs an R rating. I don't think a Batman movie has to be an R rating to be good. You know, case in point, every Batman movie that came before.
Right.
But if they want to be different, if the plan is no longer to copy the Marvel formula, which I think they shouldn't, this is how you differentiate yourself. You know, Disney and Marvel are never going to take it to that R rating. They're never going to go to that place. You could do...
Without exceptions, anyway.
Right, and you could do those maybe a little bit bloodier or stronger language or, you know, just things like that, or just imagery, you know. You can bring in John Constantine and have him smoke, something Disney will never do,
right.
Kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm not against that idea. I don't think every single movie needs that. We don't need to see, like, Superman punching the villain's heart out of their chest, because
right.
That's just not what Superman does. But, you know, you could still do different things.
It's interesting. I think, obviously, they're catering more to the people that are actually buying the movie tickets.
Yeah.
They're catering towards the adults.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm afraid, I think you might lose a little bit when it comes to the home video, because you're losing the, you can't bring it home to the family kind of thing. That's where I think, yeah, like, not all of them need to be. And I think that could be a mistake if they just decide, no, we're going to be the R-rated superhero franchise, you know, studio.
Yeah.
Because then, yeah, you cut off all the kids
mm-hmm.
that, you know, that built up everything. That's the reason you have these movies
right.
or whatever, or because of the kids that used to read these comic books or whatever, and they're still reading the comic books. I don't know. I think if the story's right, and you can have certain stories and tell the certain stories, like the Marvel has, like they did with the Deadpools and the Wolverine
well, that was
film.
All Fox.
But it's still owned by, it's still...
It is now.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's Marvel characters, I guess.
Right. Right. That works for those Marvel characters. I just don't know, because there's a lot of talk of, like, the plan is to bring Deadpool into the MCU. Will he be rated R? Nobody has come right out and said it definitely will be.
Right.
Let alone, will there actually be a third Deadpool movie? They keep saying they want to, but nobody's committed one way or the other yet. And so until something gets announced, we can't assume it's going to happen.
Well, and there's no reason. I think Deadpool is a character you could do a PG-13 film or an R film, and that character can still work. You can still have a lot of fun with that character. Same with the Wolverine character. You know, you can have him in your PG-13 films, and the character works. You can do an R-rated film, and it still works. So, yeah, just like throwing all your eggs in one basket, which is, it sounds a little bit like DC's looking at it, I think could be a mistake.
Yeah.
Just pick the characters, pick the right characters, tell the right stories, and go, okay, yeah, let's go ahead and ramp this one up and give it the R. But you don't necessarily have to do that with everything.
Right. Like, I really hope the next Shazam movie...
Yeah, that would
stays
be PG-13. That would be horrible.
It's all about family and kids and all of that.
Right.
You don't need to take it to that next level.
Right.
Billy doesn't have to start dropping F-bombs just because you want an R rating.
Right. And that's exactly what the kind of thing I'd be a little bit concerned with. And I don't like the idea of alienating half your audience.
Sure.
Just because you want to be, you know, edgy or something. Mm-hmm. Or I guess that's my...
Right.
My fear and thought on it.
Right.
Yeah.
My feelings are the same as yours. Like, pick the right ones that should be rated R. If you're doing something that's like The Suicide Squad, which is the villain movie.
Yeah.
We can go harder with
that.
Oh,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Or something like you were talking like the Birds of Prey.
Right.
Well, that's fine because you're bringing in some characters that really haven't had their day in film anywhere else.
Right.
They're not as maybe as well known.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly.
And Harley Quinn's kind of headlining it a little bit.
Right. That one, yeah, you can absolutely get by with going ahead and doing the R-rated, and that you'll probably have a more successful film because of it.
Right.
But yeah, you can't just go, oh, yeah, the next Batman's going to be R-rated. The next Wonder Woman, you know, is R-rated. Like,
why?
Take her back to how she began with that lasso. Give it the R rating.
Yeah, that's what I would really be concerned with, is it they turn into almost more superhero exploitation or right. something. They're like, in this film, Wonder Woman's going to be topless. I'm like, yeah, it's not what you need. And so, yeah, right. you really have to walk a fine line and just do it right. Just don't screw it, screw it up.
Pick and choose. So, other thing, and this kind of hurts because of when it was announced. It was 2 days, or a day maybe, before Thanksgiving, they announced that Mystery Science Theater 3000 will not be renewed on Netflix.
Yeah.
Fine, you're going to cancel it. That's okay. Stay the hell away from Thanksgiving.
Turkey Day.
That is their day. We watched the live marathon that they were that they had. Like that every year we put that on. It's just something that plays on in the background until we actually like sit and watch something else. So yeah, I mean, the first season was kind of hit or miss with how funny it was. They were figuring.
I didn't enjoy
out.
It at all.
Second season's a lot better.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I've heard that from a few people. Anyway.
And I took in their live show last year. That was a riot, an absolute riot. They really had figured stuff out with their writing and their timing and their jokes and just who, like, how the dynamics work. And I really would have looked forward to a third season. I think that probably would have been the one that hit it out of the park.
Yeah, maybe they just needed to give it one more time. Because, yeah, that first season, I tried watching it. And I was just like, man,
pacing
it's just,
was bad.
Oh, the pacing is like, guys, slow down. You don't have to tell every joke you thought of.
Right.
Which and is what it felt like.
They pulled off on that in the second season. I think they heard that feedback. I think they noticed that. But, yeah, they were on to something. And you know what? It's a show that always finds its way back. I wouldn't doubt if in like 5-10 years it comes back again in another form. I really like Jonah. I hope he sticks with it if it ever comes back. I hope his schedule allows that. Because I know like the show originally was like a big influence on him. And so it was a literal dream come true for him to land that role as the test subject. And I remember when it was first announced that it was coming up, Patton Oswalt, he like shared the text exchange between him and Joel, where Joel was like, so we're bringing back MST3K. Would you be interested? And he was like, would I? And they were like, great, because we were thinking about you as one of the Mads. And he freaks out and he shared that. And it's like, that's what this show means to great comedians. Like, it means something. To not have it is just not a world I want to be in.
Right. No, I don't think it's going to go. It'll definitely resurface somewhere, somehow. I've been watching a lot of the original show
stuff.
And a lot of it, I was been watching it, so I kind of went back to the beginning, you know, watched a lot of some of the first and second, you know, third, you know, and it was rough too.
Yep.
I mean, it needed a few seasons to really kick off. It wasn't until, I'm thinking really, until you get into season
3-4.
Later three, you start getting more hits than misses, but a really 4-6, I think, are probably like the golden age of Mystery Science Theater. And then it starts after that, you know, they start jumping networks. More of the cast leave, you lose both the original Mads leave. And it just starts kind of, you know, there's a few gems in there. But yeah, it's kind of like it lost its momentum a little bit. It's kind of got the wind knocked out of it, and it just kind of petered out at the end. Which I still watched it all.
Right, you're there because you're there.
Yeah, but there is that golden age just towards the very end of Joel and the beginning of Mike is just like that's like the best of what Mystery Science Theater had to offer.
So let's ask the controversial question: who's your preferred three?
Oh, I have to admit, I kind of fall into Mike.
Okay.
I liked a lot of what Joel did. Absolutely. I mean, we wouldn't have the show without him.
Yep.
But yeah, when it just comes to the episodes I find the funniest, they're usually, they fall into the Mike episodes. Something about the way the humor changed a little bit, his sort of like big dopey white guy from Wisconsin or whatever just really worked for me. And I just really enjoy a lot of those episodes.
And then how about for Crow?
The original Trace Crow. Yeah, Trace Bellew is the only Crow for me. Was it Bill Corbett, I think, took over?
Yeah.
he's great, and I enjoy him. He does a lot of the riff tracks now with Kevin Murphy and Mike, and he's good. Again, he has some hits, but as far as just like consistency, it's got to be Trace.
And preferred Tom Servo, even though that's always a scam.
That's Kevin Murphy. Yeah. Kevin. Always Kevin Murphy. Yeah.
No Josh Weinstein.
Yeah, no. Josh is an acquired taste. Again, there's some real
kid when like he.
Oh, he was really young. He had to have been in his 20s when that show thing, when that took off.
Yeah, to me, my introduction to MST3K was the movie. This Island Earth. That was the first thing I ever saw.
Wow.
So to me, I've always gravitated to that three of Mike, Kevin,
and Bill.
And
that was still Trace.
That was still Trace. But so I feel that's like, to me, the best MST3K, yet I think Bill replacing Trace is better for riff tracks. I like Bill in riff tracks more than I liked him in MST3K because they're all themselves now.
A little bit, yeah.
And so the personalities are a little bit different. Mm-hmm. But so, yeah, that was my introduction. And then I had no idea who Joel was until I saw a Joel episode. I was like, who's this guy? And then Sarah had to explain it to me. She's like, oh, you don't know the history? I was like, no, I thought it was just this.
Right. Yeah, that's funny. I didn't have cable at the time. A friend did, and he would record all the the episodes, and we would every weekend we'd end up at his house to watch whatever MST aired that weekend, and that's how I watched the whole show, which I think is that's how you were supposed to watch Mystery Science Theater. You were supposed to tape it and then get it together with your friends and family and watch it. That was the way it was supposed to be done.
Exactly.
And that's the way we did it, and we watched them all, and we saw Joel leave and saw Mike come on, and some of my best memories of that time of my life is sitting around that basement and we're all laughing with tears streaming down our face at some of the jokes. And what did he say? I don't know. I was laughing too hard.
Right.
I missed
Rewind it.
I'm still watching things and like catching jokes I didn't hear before.
One of my favorite jokes is, I can't remember what the movie is. The one with Rosdauer.
Oh, Mitchell. No, not Mitchell. Is that
Final Sacrifice?
Final Sacrifice. That's it. Yes, yes.
Where Rosdauer and the kid, they like run away from the cult, but their running away is like 8 seconds, and then they're hiding in the trees, and they're both like huffing and puffing, and one of them just goes, "You ran like 10 feet. Get over it."
And that's a later one. That's like that's Sci-Fi Channel. Yeah. Mystery Science
I just
Theater.
Love that joke because I caught that once on TV, and I was like, okay, what's happened? And then that line hit, and I just lost it. I don't even remember the rest of the episode. I laughed so hard at that.
I got a chance to go to Minneapolis and St. Paul, actually get a tour of the studio, of the Mystery Science Theater studio.
Oh, nice.
It was, I guess it was right before the movie premiered. No, it was just after the movie premiered because they actually did the movie again for the live audience and did their own,
their own version.
Live riffs and everything during the film. So it was just after the film or whatever. And so I got to see the studio and everything. I got to see their Peabody Award. just hanging on the wall. It looks like an altar on the wall. It was a lot of fun. But we're turning this into the Mystery Science Theater episode. And
what's wrong with that?
Yeah, no, there's nothing wrong with it, honestly. It is a show that I think, it has its place. It's just you got to do the right jokes. That's something else I realized too is when I'm watching the older films, they don't necessarily do a lot of making fun of
the
movie.
They just point out the mistakes. Or they add their own lines.
They add their own lines. They throw out a lot of jokes that just are related to what's going on. But they very rarely do they sit there and go, "Oh, that's stupid." They're not really making fun of a lot of the films until some of the latter episodes. I saw it as it creeped into some of the sci-fi stuff and everything. They really start poking more fun at the film and at the filmmakers, which I like. Oh, that kind of sours me. I liked it better before. And riff tracks, usually they're okay, but they still fall into the make fun of versus just having fun with.
Okay.
But there's still a few that are still absolute gems that actually the best, I think the one I found the funniest that I have seen so far is actually none of the regulars. It was actually, was it Mary Jo and, I can't think of her name. It's Mike's wife. it was two women, and they riffed. Oh, crud! Now I'm blanking on the film.
Was this during like the 30th anniversary when like everybody was? I think it was a Riff Tracks.
This was a Riff Tracks, yeah. But it was just these two. Was it Amazon Women on the Moon? Not Amazon Women on the Moon. Oh.
Yeah, because I think it was like the 30th anniversary of Mr. Science Theater. It was a Riff Tracks, but they invited all the different people from the show's history, but they each took their own segments.
It was just their own film. Their film, and I should really look it up. But it was hilarious.
Yeah, those two are funny.
It just because it was the two women, and you know, so much of the plot revolves around you know men over all these this society of women that are on the moon or whatever. And maybe it was Amazon Women on the Moon, something like that. And it's just, it's hysterical how, you know, they got to go with the woman that, you know, she's a member of the crew and she's a scientist and everything. And then, of course, she pulls out her makeup thing and they're like, oh, thanks, Janet. Never mind. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Hilarious.
MST3K got canceled. I'm hoping one day it'll come back. I'll be there for it.
It will. I mean, yeah, it got canceled off of Netflix. Yeah, there's a lot of other services out there. I don't know. They're still tied in with Shout Factory, aren't they?
Yeah.
Shout Factory has their own streaming service.
Right. That's how we watch the live one.
Yeah. So I see it just showing
up
there.
It's a rights issue at this point.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. All right. Any other news?
No news, but I did take in a few movies. I saw Parasite. I don't know if you heard about that one. It's a South Korean film.
Oh, yes, I have heard about that. I've heard about it. Yeah.
Go see
and that's
that
what
movie.
I've heard about it.
It's fantastic. Great, great story about like the divide in like the class systems, but like you don't really root for either side, but you don't root against either side. You're kind of in this point where you're like, I don't want them to get caught, but I kind of want to see what happens if they get caught thing.
South Korea's got it's their film.
It was really good.
They keep every now, it's like once a year or every other year, some film comes out of that country that is just amazing. That's the country to watch out for. They're going to like storm like theater someday.
Probably.
Yeah.
Or they'll just get bought out. Like, it was really good coming out of there. They work for us now.
Yeah.
Saw Ford versus Ferrari.
Yeah.
Also really, really good.
Yeah, it's one I've heard. Yeah.
Great, great racing sequences really gets you like behind the wheel. You feel like you're going 125 right. miles an hour. saw The Good Liar.
I recognize the name.
And Helen Mirren and Ian McKellen. It was one of those
great
movies.
Cast.
Yeah, wonderful. They're both like just in perfect
kind
harmony
of,
with
I,
each
yeah,
other.
Just kind of watch those people, you know.
Yeah.
Read recipes or something.
Exactly. And it's one of those movies that's going along, you're really into it, and then like the last 15 minutes, it's like, you're ready for a ton of exposition to explain how everything happened, and I'm sitting there going like, no, don't do this, and they do it. And you get this whole flashback sequence that lasts, that feels like a day and a half, and I'm sitting there going, nothing set this up, nothing hinted at this. You just stop this movie to a halt, and oh, why? I just would have been fine with like, hey, why did you do this? Because I'm better at it than you. I would have been fine with that. Instead, it's like, oh, you've asked that question. Now I will tell you.
It's disappointing. That's a shame.
Yeah. It really kind of bummed me out for the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Please don't do that.
And no payoff or anything for it in the end. Just doesn't really...
It thinks it's a payoff, but I'm sitting there going like, yeah, but you didn't set any of that up. You think you're clever, but you're not.
That's unfortunate. Well.
And then not a movie, but I have started watching Disney Plus's The Mandalorian.
Oh, yeah.
4 episodes are out. I've seen all 4 episodes. It's a good show.
Yeah?
Yeah. What I really like about the character so far in every single episode, at least once, sometimes twice... He needs to be saved.
Mm.
So, you know, the trailer and all that makes it seem like he's a Mandalorian. He's the perfect fighter. He's the perfect machine. Nobody can stop him. That's not true. He needs help a lot. He's a very capable bounty hunter and a capable warrior, but he's not perfect. And what they're really showing is the Star Wars universe, the galaxy, and all the planets, there's a lot of ways to die. And he's lucky to get out of each and every one of them, and he needs help. And I like that kind of vulnerable hero. Because as this goes on, the stakes are getting raised. And I'm thinking, like, if he doesn't have help, he might die at the end of this series. There's no guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's a faceless character. He never takes his helmet off. He's right. It's the Mandalorian. It's not, you know, a named character.
It could just be the suit that goes from season to season.
Exactly,
yeah.
Right. This could get inherited. So, and the show shows you right at the beginning, there's other Mandalorians. He could die, and we could just follow another character mm-hmm. later. So I'm worried about this guy. I think four more episodes are coming out. I'm worried he's going to die for someone.
That'd be a great transition where the camera's just following, you know, the Mandalorian or whatever. All of a sudden, you know, a blast, boom, you know, his head's he goes down, and the camera just picks up from the shooter and just follows him.
Yeah.
that's the rest of the episode, and then the next season, and that's it. Like, right. What?
Yeah, they really could. So, yeah, it's some interesting storytelling going on.
Sweet. Nice. It's nice to see that, you know, this seems to be like the series is sort of saving the Star Wars franchise from like all the fans like this.
Yeah,
versus
so far.
Yeah, the usually when the film comes out or whatever, it's a 50-50, you know. This one, it's kind of like, yeah, everyone's on it. I've not heard anybody really disparage this at all.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a few people point out, I was like, oh, okay, so they cribbed Seven Samurai, or yeah, they did that. But
they
it's still but they're like, but it's still good story. It's still good storytelling. You know, at least right. They're cribbing good stories.
Exactly. And those are just classic stories at this point.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, considering the original Star Wars, you could argue cribbed a little bit from
a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
From Japanese culture. It makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. This is a little, so it's mostly a Western.
Don't think of it as crib. Think of it as an homage.
Continuing what it's always done.
Exactly.
Right. So, yeah, I'm enjoying it, and I do recommend it. That's it.
All righty. Well, I want to read a couple things. We got some feedback on the last couple episodes. Let's see, which one came out first? I think my 31 Nights of Halloween episode came out, and Jeff Owens commented on the Facebook post here. He says, Christopher, you more than made up for your shocking comment about the return of Dracula being better than Hammer's Dracula. I almost swerved and drove off the road. By relating your experience, I made up for it by relating my experience with A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. I watched it on Shudder, then immediately ordered the Blu-ray from Amazon. What an amazing film. It really struck a chord with me, and I also could not wait to watch it again. I also agree with you about the Monster Squad. I never took to it, and I sure tried. Although I felt the same about Fright Night, and eventually came around. So we agree on 2 out of 3. That's not bad. What a great month of viewing. Thanks for sharing. So thank you, Jeff, for commenting there. I know it was a not a popular opinion, but. And then we did get a letter here from Floyd. He listened to our the final countdown episode. I figured he probably listened to that pretty quick after it dropped because he was curious. He says, great, great episode. After hearing your discussion about the final countdown, after playing my piece, I really wish I could have been with you guys. I think you can relate to that. I agree with everything you said about the film. It was indeed a collection of scenes, but really cool scenes. Your discussion about what the film could have done story-wise was, in my opinion, some of the best discussion I've heard you guys do. I had mentioned in my piece that I'd like to see the film remade today just to see the battle between the Nimitz and the Japanese fleet. While that would be cool, I'd rather see the story fleshed out like you discussed. All kinds of possibilities there. I loved Matt's idea of the film opening with divers finding the sunken ship, which hasn't sunk yet. So who's going to start working on the story? Great work, guys. Floyd. Yeah, so thank you very much for sending that in, Floyd. Yeah, that was a fun discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And I still think about that of like, no, what you do is this.
Right.
I keep thinking of little ways that you could work that story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A lot to do with that story that they just didn't do.
Yes. All right, well, that's all for news. It's all our feedback and everything. So let's take a break, and when we get back, we're going to talk about 2004's Collateral.
Hello, this is Gorham.
And I'm Reginald Thistlewhite.
And we're from the Friends and Players
podcast. Do you like Dungeons and Dragons?
Do you like pop culture references?
Do you like listening to idiot blowhards running around in circles accomplishing nothing?
Then do we have the show for you. Listen to Friends and Flayers on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and other major podcast platforms.
And if you do drop by, be sure to rate and subscribe so you never miss a future episode.
Are you looking for some great indie podcasts to listen to? Check out the Pod Nation list on podchaser.com, where you can find a list of great indie podcasts, get links to their official websites, and even listen to some of their episodes without needing to create an account or log in. So once again, for some great indie podcasts, check out the Pod Nation list on podchaser.com.
All right, Collateral. Like I discussed last time, Tom Cruise is an actor that I have some issues with. I don't know what it is. I just never really found myself liking Tom Cruise, but he's in such great movies. Collateral, I have to admit, is one of them. even if it's a really good movie, it's like, damn you, Tom Cruise, stop making good movies.
Can't help himself. No. Can't turn it off.
No. And, it apparently, what's it? The first thing that struck me is Tom Cruise in Collateral as the bad guy isn't really all that different than Tom Cruise as a good guy in any other film.
He brings the same energy, the same intensity.
Yeah, but it's like,
just this, changed what side he's on.
I said, this could easily be Joel Goodson from Risky Business, all grown up and maladjusted.
Yeah.
It's the same guy.
This
it could be the
Ethan
same guy.
Hunt in Mission Impossible doing the same thing.
Yeah.
They just were like, well, just have him kill.
It just depends on who the target is.
Yeah, exactly. Just have him threaten an innocent man.
This is Maverick. In an alternate universe where he was kicked out of the Navy.
Right. And he became a hitman.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. This was your pick.
Yep.
When was the first time you saw this film?
Probably not long after it came out. It was one of those things that, like, just HBO would show over and over again. So it was probably like 2005-ish that I saw it. And it was just one of those movies that it was so different, since Tom Cruise is the bad guy. And he's not even like a morally gray bad guy. He's a bad guy.
Right.
Who will not hesitate to kill anyone who just looks at him wrong.
A moral-free bad guy. He has no,
So, yeah, to me, it's just one of those things where it just sort of stands out as, like, the anomaly of his career of, like, here's that one time he clearly was a villain that you don't root for.
But you have a synopsis? And then we'll do the synopsis, and we'll get into it a little more.
So, written by Stuart Beatty, directed by Michael Mann, Max is a cab driver in L.A. who has dreams of owning his own high-end limo company. He picks up Vincent, a seemingly nice man who wants Max to get him to his 5 stops before heading to the airport. Little does Max know that Vincent is a hitman and all the stops are targets, including the lawyer Max met earlier that day.
Yeah, I have to admit, it took me a lot longer to figure out where's the lawyer coming back into this? What was the point with all that? Didn't even occur to me until right towards the end, like, oh, duh.
5 targets. And he scopes out the building at the beginning. He steals the key card.
So we've got Tom Cruise. We've got Jamie Foxx as Max, the cab driver, who is brilliant in this. I mean, Jamie Foxx is he's a phenomenal actor. Jada Pinkett Smith is the lawyer who was in the film for like 5 minutes at the beginning and 5 minutes in the end.
And she's good.
She's great. She's fine. And then Mark Ruffalo is an LAPD officer who also
has one of the saddest stories ever.
Yeah, very much. And it was so funny. He shows up, and I didn't even recognize.
With the slick hair.
And the weird facial hair. And he's so much younger, because this is 2004, 15 years ago or whatever. But he's like such a baby face.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, until we actually had lines and actually spoke, and I'm like, that's Mark Ruffalo. I kept waiting for Mark Ruffalo to show up, and I'm like looking right at him. And those are the big stars, and there are a few other actors that show up that you'll probably recognize, just character actors that you'll see. The one, I think it was Bruce McGill who was the FBI or something. The guys that were I know him from
A lot of things.
But I looked through his filmography and it was like, oh, that's the guy from. And like, no, that wasn't him. But and I'm looking through it, but he's been in everything. So it's like I just know him from stuff. So, my point being, phenomenal cast.
Yes.
And yeah, Tom Cruise, you know, he's they gray his hair. They kind of, you know, do the salt and pepper thing to his hair, give him a little bit of age. And he is just a really nice, polite, but yeah, you want bad things to happen to the man.
Yes.
And I love the fact that he is just that, he's that ultimate hitman. You know, he doesn't really care. Mm-hmm. It's a job. And he even tells Max his philosophy is like, look, we're one speck in a universe. What difference does it make? You know, with this guy dies, I die. You know, none of it matters.
Right.
Like, oh, that's psychopath stuff right
yes.
there.
And then he starts, you know, then Max starts getting all like, you know, nervous and sick to his stomach. Like, you just killed a man. He's like, yeah. Do you ever hear of Rwanda? How many people died instantly? People haven't died that instantly since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Did you
join?
Did you do anything? No. But one guy falls onto the roof of your cab and all of a sudden you're worked up about it. And it's like, whoa. Yeah.
Like, I hate it when psychopaths make sense.
Right.
Yeah, the film does a great job of really building up Max as being this really nice guy. I mean, it spends like the good first 10, 15 minutes of this film just building up that Max is a good person.
Mm-hmm.
He's good at his job. He cares about his job, his part-time job that he's now been doing for 12 years.
That's
just to set, you know, till he gets stuff set up to do his limo job or whatever. But he's, you know, he makes sure his cab is clean. He goes through all the safety checks before he leaves the garage. I mean, he is like the ultimate.
Yeah. And I really like, you know, the opening of the movie where he's giving the lawyer, Annie, a ride, and he's like, you know, I can get you there faster, and if I'm wrong, it'll be a free cab ride. And he has that nice conversation with her, and she's mm-hmm. like, you know, how do you feel about being the best at what you do? And he's like, oh, this is just temporary, and he's not giving you any other details. He's like, just temporary. I'm going to set up my own limo service. And you think, like, this is a guy with a plan. This is a guy with a dream. He knows what he's doing. And then he has almost the identical conversation with Tom Cruise's character, but he's not flirting with Tom Cruise's character like he was with her. So he's like, no, this is temporary. How long have you been doing it? 12 years. Now you get more detail and you're like, oh, it's a pipe dream.
Mm-hmm.
You have this grand idea, but you're never going to do it. You're just saying that. Like, he's got the books of like the Lexus and he's looking through all the models, but it's like, he's never going to do it. You don't plan for 12 years, then finally do it.
Right.
So you find out just in those two exchanges, you get an idea of who he is, but then you find out he's all talk and probably a coward. He's never going to actually make his business because he's afraid it's going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see that scene with his mom and you're like, oh, that's why he's insecure. And you learn about his character all through these interactions. It's great storytelling.
So, and what's funny is this, as horrific of the events of this night is probably going to be the impetus that he needs to kick him in the pants and actually work on making his dream come true.
Yes.
I want to see Collateral 2, and
it's just his life.
And it's Max's, you know, driving the island limo service.
Mm-hmm. And when you know it, the next hitman gets in the back.
We don't get all muddy with some of the details about why or what. It's just some of the stuff comes out that, oh, these guys that are going down are all witnesses to some, to like the city's prosecution of some guy they think is a crime lord, who turns out he is, but doesn't get down bogged down with all that stuff.
Right.
It is just about Vincent and Max and their night. I mean, that's it. And it's like this simple story. And what's crazy is like, this story doesn't really seem all that outrageous.
No.
I mean, this is a very grounded
right. It doesn't
plot.
Escalate. It doesn't get to the point where like somebody's jumping off a helicopter.
Right.
There's no massive explosion. It's just a car drives, some guns are fired, and then the movie's over.
Yeah.
The one car crash, it just flips over. They walk out.
And they claw there.
Yeah. You know, they're bruised, they're bloody, but that's what would happen. Like, there's no big fire or anything.
Yeah. Well, even just the very premise just seems...
Hitman in the backseat.
Yeah. This seems like effectively kidnaps a cab driver to force him to go from hit to hit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to say that hasn't happened.
Right.
Uh, That seems very possible and very likely that that could be happening right now in L.A.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's even that part where the Mark Ruffalo's detective, Detective Fanning, he's like, well, there was that case in Oakland where they were like, you know, the cab driver went around, killed three people, then killed himself. That detective was convinced that that wasn't the cab driver that did it. And I'm sitting there thinking, like, Max is going to die.
Yeah.
Because that was Vincent.
Yeah, you never feel like Max is going to come out of this alive.
No.
And I'm not going to spoil whether or not he does. You know, like I said, we always spoil things on here, but you know, give away the very ending? No. Not on this one.
Did you notice and get the little Easter egg at the very beginning of the movie as Vincent is walking through the building and bumps into somebody with the briefcase?
Oh, yeah, that was it's
Jason Statham.
Statham, thank you. I couldn't think of his name.
And so that was a nod to the transporter.
Nice.
It was their way of saying that's the same character. That's his delivery. No questions asked. He dropped off his package and he got out of there.
Nice.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's the same universe. Tied universe there?
Yeah. So Max could show up in a transporter movie.
Nice. I think I saw the first one of those.
First one's okay, but it's one of those, you know, cars go fast, everything explodes. Here's a sex scene for
that's
no reason.
A much more over the top is what I remember on from that one. Yeah, this is big, and mainly because, like I said, I don't really seek out a lot of Tom Cruise films. I probably would have skipped over this one anyway. But no, I'm glad you brought it up and I got a chance to watch it, because it ended up being like this was an entertaining film.
Yeah.
And it helps that you have some really great actors. Jamie Foxx, who, I mean, he's gone on. This was relatively early in his career, one in 2004, kind of when he's first kind of coming into.
Earlier half, definitely.
Yeah. And he's gone on to do some amazing stuff since then. And yeah, he's going to be an actor that I think will continue to go on and do amazing things.
He kind
things.
Of always like picks and chooses his roles and picks them wisely, and he puts his effort into every single one.
Yeah. Right,
This was just one of those
really
interesting character decisions. I really liked how he played Max. You know, Max is a coward throughout the movie. Max is begging for his life, which is understandable.
Sure.
I'd be doing the same thing. But I like all of the different little things that happen to Max of like, okay, where he's like, hey, just take the cab. Just take the cab. You know, you can have it. And then Vincent's like, you promise not to tell anyone? Yeah, that's fine. Get in the car.
Yeah, there's little hints throughout this movie that it's going to be a different kind of movie. Like that earlier, I was like, oh, okay, there's going to be a little bit of humor. Yeah, not much.
No, but they sprinkle it in here and there.
You get the hint that maybe they're going to give Vincent some redeeming qualities when they go to the jazz club.
Right.
And they end up sitting with the jazz musician, and they're having drinks, and they're telling stories about Miles Davis, you know, and even Max is like getting into it. He's enjoying it and everything.
He's
and then,
forgetting this is a killer next to him.
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, oh, okay. And then, but no.
That's his target.
Yeah. Vincent's horrible.
Right. But then Vincent also does a handful of things like, there's the part where they go to that nightclub, and for no reason, he saves Max's life.
Mm.
Like, someone has a clear shot on Max. People think Max is Vincent.
Right.
He could have let that happen, snuck out, and people would think they got their man, but he saves his life.
Mm-hmm. Why?
Why? I still don't get why.
Yeah,
he doesn't explain why. He says, like, oh, I like you. It's like, is that why?
And you almost get the feeling that Vincent doesn't really know why either.
Right.
You get kind of like an odd look on his face. It was just real passing, just kind of like, huh, why'd I do that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a couple moments where you see both him and Vincent and Max in just different situations where there's contemplative moments where somebody says something or something happens, and it's like, they both have to kind of process that.
Yeah.
And that's where you get, you know, okay, let's do some LA beauty shots.
Yeah.
LA at night is a beautiful city. Yeah. I'll have to admit it.
This was a little bit of a love letter to LA, because towards the end, when you're up in like the high rise and all the lights are out, the only lights that are coming in are through the windows of the city. And it's just sort of like somebody just wanted you to know they love how LA looks.
Yeah, that was the one thing about the films. Like, I hate when when like the big finale and showdown of a film, or at least the beginning of it, is dependent on the building not having proper fire safety equipment in the rooms. When he cuts out the power and the entire room goes black, I'm like, there should probably be some lights.
There should There's be some a generator somewhere.
Or the battery powered emergency lights that are in like every office building.
Right.
Strangely are missing from this one floor.
Or like he knocks out the lights. The lights go out, but then we see Max get into the building.
And all the lights are on. So they only cut out the lights to the top floors?
Right. Is that how that works? Or is the building gridded separately?
I don't know.
I don't think so.
Yeah. They did have emergency lights in the hallway, so that's good. But I'm thinking, they'd leave at least have one
We don't
in the
need
room.
Them in the library. Someone made that
Who's going to be reading? Yeah.
In a law library.
They're in an emergency.
The only real bit of humor, there's two very clear moments when Max's boss calls him and he's like, what'd you mean you got into an accident? And that's when Vincent pretends to be the lawyer and the boss is like, whoa, let's not get carried away. Carried away? You're harassing my driver.
Right.
I'm going to sue you for everything you're worth. I'm sorry. Tell him he's an asshole. You're an asshole.
Yes. Yeah, that's a little bit of humor, but even that scene is strictly...
It's tense, too.
It's also tense, and it's the only reason Vincent is doing it. It's not out of the goodness of his heart. It's just to keep this guy off the other guy's back so they don't have more people looking for him.
Which is the same reason in the other funny scene when they go and visit Max's mom. She's hilarious.
Yeah, yes.
She's like, what'd you get me flowers for? Well, that guy bought you flowers. That was so nice of you. And I'm just sitting there being like, wow, a lot of people can relate to this, can't they?
I don't want you spending any money, but you bought me those flowers. They're beautiful. What? Wait, what?
Yeah, he's in the corner like, what do I have to do?
Yeah, it's frightening. I mean, that's where this film could almost be a horror, because what is happening to Max is terrifying. Mm-hmm. You can put yourself in his situation, and now this guy is threatening your life. You know that he could kill you at any moment. Now he knows where to find your mother.
Yep.
He knows where you work. No matter what, you're going to spend the rest of your life looking over your shoulder, you know, if this film turned out any different way. This is a horror film.
Yes, absolutely. The first couple of times I saw this movie, I always really used to hate Detective Fanning's story.
Mm.
Now I love it.
Really?
This will get into spoiler territory a little bit, because you've got Mark Ruffalo playing Detective Fanning, who's the first person to start piecing together something's off, because he's going to check on one of his CIs, and that was the first target.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one, you know, everybody's like, well, the guy just clearly jumped out of his window. It's like, well, where'd the body go then? So someone move this body. So he starts looking into it, and then he goes to the morgue, and then when he goes to the morgue, that's when Max is visiting his mom, so they're in the same hospital. So he really, even though... They're in the same elevator. Even though Max doesn't know that's a detective, the detective doesn't know that's a hitman. But it starts setting up this feeling of, this is the guy who's going to save him. This is the guy who's going to swoop in and get Max to safety and kill the hitman. And then that's when he's at the morgue and he's like, okay, my CI's not in here, but I recognize the face of this other guy who is target number two.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts realizing witnesses are getting killed who are all connected to the same guy. He talks to the feds. The feds are like, that's our case.
Mm-hmm.
And then the feds get taken out at the club, and it's like, okay, they're a non-factor. Fanning finds Max, and he's the one who's like, this is not our killer. This is not the hitman. This is just some cabbie for the last 12 years. He didn't become a hitman overnight.
Right.
And he's dragging him out of the club, and Vincent guns him down.
Mm-hmm.
And he's dead. And that's it. And it really just goes like, oh, there's the only lifeline Max had. It's dead. Crap, what happens to Max? Because the first time I saw it, I was like, wait, that's it? That's what happens to that cop? A good cop who does his job well? He's dead now? That really bothered me. But now I'm like, oh, the hero's got to save himself.
Mm-hmm.
Is he going to be able to do that? Because he's been a coward this whole time.
Right.
And I love that little twist. It took every bit of what you're used to in this kind of movie, and it just snuffed it out.
Right.
It set you up for it, and then it's like, that's not this kind of film. And you're just sitting there going like, damn, I don't know where this ending's going.
Yeah, if you just look at it from that cop's story, it's kind of like, well, he didn't even need to be there.
Right.
But why that happened, that is what helps, I think, helps push Max to the realization that he's the only one that's been able to get him out of this of this situation.
No one's going to save me.
Right. So, yeah, in that regard, that was a very important character, although it doesn't seem like it, and it seems like, oh, well, what's the point of that?
Yeah.
There's a very good point. Yeah.
Yeah, so that part really grew on me over the years. I thought that was just a brilliant decision.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was the other actor who was in this who was not famous at the time. You had Javier Bardem as Felix.
Which one was
No Country for he's the guy who's like telling the story about Santa Claus and
the crime boss or whatever he was.
He would go on to be the villain in No Country for Old Men. He was the villain in Skyfall, the James Bond movie.
Okay.
He's a great actor. This is like one of his earliest roles. And I forgot he was in this movie. So when the scene came up, I was like, wait a minute, that's Javier Bardem.
Nice.
And he's terrifying in that scene. He's terrifying in every scene he's in.
I like that scene, though, where Max finally has to, like, he's pretending to be Vincent.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's my favorite scene in the movie.
Yeah, and he finally just has to dig deep and, like, put on this front and turn into Vincent.
Yeah.
And even quoting Vincent and everything to try to sell himself off as this hitman. It's one of those things that, you know, in real life, if you and I tried that, it probably wouldn't work.
No, I'd be dead. Can you give me the workups?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's not a hitman.
Yeah. Tell that guy I'm going to kill him.
Why is he cocking the gun? Yeah, I really like that scene and what Max has to do to get out alive.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's really just every moment in this film just turns into just you're wondering where it's going. And then it's just it turns into a great moment. And you're kind of wondering why all the beauty shots of L.A., you know, cause like, boy, this is a 2-hour film. You could cut this to an hour and a half if you just get to
took
where
out
you're
the
going.
Driving scenes.
If you took out the driving, took out the camera under the helicopter for no reason other than to show the skyline, you know. Honestly, I really like that about this film.
Yeah.
L.A. often gets kind of disparaged, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You don't usually see it as being a beautiful place. You know, it's always the smog shrouded, the traffic, you know. This all takes place at night. The traffic is almost non-existent. Whether that's realistic or not, I don't know. I'm not. Mm-hmm. I don't live in L.A. Anyone in L.A. can write us and let me know. So it was really nice seeing the city kind of, it was really beautiful. It was a weird kind of juxtaposition between this dark story that's going on in this, what looks like a really beautiful city.
Yeah.
And it really adds to the enjoyment of watching the film.
Yeah. And I really feel that LA is probably the only, like maybe you could have done this in New York because it kind of has that same feel. Because yeah, Vincent has that whole story in the beginning about like he hates LA, he hates how there's just so many people but nobody knows each other, mm-hmm. which is like it sets up how he's able to do what he can do. He can abduct this one cab driver and drive around from place to place and go completely unnoticed. He can do these horrible things. Like he shoots two guys
in an alley
like 100 feet from the main road. And you don't hear a scream. You don't hear anyone yell, call 911.
Nothing.
It's just, he even has like a casual conversation with Max for like a minute before they get back into the car.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, all right, drive off.
Same with in the beginning when the guy plummets, you know, 4 stories onto the top of Max's car.
Nothing happens.
They're in that alley for a good 10, 15 minutes at least. You know, they're moving the body. They're cleaning the blood off the top of the car. Nothing. Nobody. Yep. Nobody pays any attention. No one looks out the window. Or even if they did, they're not going to say anything.
Right.
Whatever.
They're going to duck right back in.
Yeah, exactly. That was the only thing of the film that I didn't catch is the why they took the body.
In yeah, the, he left all the other bodies.
Yeah, exactly. Why they took that, why they didn't just toss him off the cab and just leave him. Yeah.
That's a really good point. Yeah, he leaves all the other bodies.
All it does is set up that
bit at
one,
the
one bit at the end when he has the accident and the cop finds the body in the trunk of the crash cab.
Uh-huh.
And it makes Max have to be the bad guy a little bit there.
Yeah.
In order to escape so he can save the woman.
Yeah.
That's the only point of that body being in a trunk.
Yeah,
I didn't know if I missed something. Was there,
I could only speculate, but I feel they don't really fit of like, okay, if there's a body, because like if there's no body, because like there's the whole point where Detective Fanning is like, you know, clearly somebody moved this body, this, that, and the other, but other people are like, well, who did that? Why did that? Like it confuses the moment. Like if there's no body, is there a murder kind of thing? Maybe he's just trying to slow the investigation down. To avoid the pattern.
Right.
Because maybe he doesn't know, because he has no idea Detective Fanning's coming looking for this guy. Detective Fanning's there for completely different reasons that have nothing to do with the case. He's just a CI that the guy's checking on. So maybe he's just trying to avoid the pattern of the bodies, figuring like, because his next target is connected to that guy and the next target and too many. And then maybe the feds pick up on what's going on at the nightclub and all that stuff. So yep, maybe he's just trying to slow it down, but
I didn't know if I missed something. I didn't know if I missed that for whatever reason someone wanted the body, the crime boss.
Yeah.
Felix wanted a trophy or something or wanted for that one particular and everyone else was just whatever, I don't need it, but yes, I wasn't sure. I was just curious about that.
No, you're probably right. That's just more plot than anything.
Mhm. There was the great line when one point where Max tries to get attention and ends up getting mugged. Vincent has strapped him to the steering wheel so he wouldn't go away while he goes and does his thing. And he tries to get some people's attention off the street, and he actually does, but they end up mugging him and walking off. Vincent comes out, takes him out, because they also got his briefcase with all his stuff. And then he's like, don't attract any more attention. You don't have the trunk space.
And then there's even the part where the cops pull the car over because the windshield's all smashed up.
Right.
And you can't drive like that. And Vincent is telling him, like, you better talk your way out of this. And he can't. He's bad at it.
Right.
Which kind of sets up the later scene with Felix of, like, he can't talk his way out of anything.
No. couldn't even convince some cops that he hit a deer.
Right. So those are just the little, like, writing moments and character moments that I appreciate of how, like, one thing sets up another thing to completely subvert your expectations. But, like, they were going to get caught.
Mm-hmm.
They were dead to rights. Vincent was going to have to kill those two cops on a busy street.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were going to have to, like, peel out and run. They got lucky that crime goes on in L.A.
Yeah.
And those cops had to go respond to another call. And that's just more of that thing of, like, it kind of had to be set in L.A. where, like, the city doesn't turn off just because it's night. Like,
right.
New York is probably the only other city you could have set this in. But I think there's something about L.A. that's a little bit better. I can't put my finger on what that is, but something about L.A. works.
Yeah, well, and maybe it's just a case of, it seems like New York would be the obvious choice.
Mm.
And, you know, we've had these stories or we've had these crime stories in New York. Having it in L.A., it just makes it a little different.
Yeah.
You know, gives you something you haven't seen before.
Sure.
Maybe. Yeah. Most of L.A. we've seen is, you know, maybe the L.A. River Basin, you know, and pick any number of films that have had chase scenes or something in the L.A. River Basin. This way it's a little bit more. Yeah. It's just something we haven't seen before.
Yeah. Yeah, I really appreciate all those little how the city plays is kind of like as its own character.
Yeah, and maybe too because L.A. doesn't necessarily sleep, but maybe more than like say New York, which is supposed to be the city that never sleeps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always something going on in New York, kind of thing. So maybe it's just a matter of maybe it is more realistic as far as the traffic and the people or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
But yeah, so that's Collateral.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's it. I absolutely recommend checking this out if you haven't already. If you just want a couple hours, good action film, kind of crime drama action film, yeah, you can't go wrong with this one. It was mm-hmm. it would be a good choice. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for bringing it to the
sure.
attention. It's
glad
awesome.
You liked it.
I did. I did enjoy it a lot. Again, Tom Cruise. Eventually, I'm just going to have to break down and say, okay, fine, like I like Tom Cruise, whatever.
You do like Tom Cruise. You just won't admit it. Oh, there was one other thing in the movie that I forgot about. The part where they're in the law office and Vincent is chasing them down and he grabs the desk chair and hurls it through the glass wall.
Oh, and the nice in the stumble.
And he falls. That's Tom Cruise actually making a mistake.
Oh, I figured.
And falling over the chair. Mm-hmm. And Michael Mann was like, that was so bizarre, I'm leaving it in. That has to be the cut. I thought that was just a nice little piece of trivia in there. So if anybody goes and watches this for the first time and sees that, you're seeing Tom Cruise actually falling, but maintaining his character and finishing his take.
Yeah, no, I figured that was not intended to happen, but it added to that little sense of realism mm-hmm. that this film really revels in.
Yeah.
So it worked. All right, so that's going to do it for Collateral. We will be back in a couple weeks, and we're going to end the year with something a little different. It's definitely something very different than what we've been discussing. This is a film I first discovered at Monster Bash 2 years ago. I think 2018's Monster Bash, they showed it. First time I watched it. This is a Boris Karloff film. It's called The Body Snatcher from 1945. This was one of the Val Lewton produced films, and it opened up a world of the Val Lewton produced films that I would recommend everybody check out. It was directed by Robert Wise, phenomenal and amazing, you know, eclectic director. Everything from this, he'd go on to do The Sound of Music, you know, things like West Side Story, but also Star Trek the Motion Picture, and of course The Haunting, which yeah. is, I know you and I both really enjoy The Haunting.
He didn't want to be pigeonholed.
No, he was not a pigeonholed director. He would do just about anything that struck his fancy or whatever. So this is one of his probably maybe earlier outings, so 1945. Really interesting film. I think it's probably Boris Karloff's best film.
Okay.
I think you're really going to enjoy it. Nice. It's a really good, great, just dark drama is really what it is, and I'm hoping you're gonna like it. Some of the ones I pull out that I'm thinking, oh, Matt's gotta watch this one, it hasn't been worked so well, but you know,
here's hoping.
So we'll be back for that one. Just, it is 1945, The Body Snatcher. It's not one of the Invasion of the Body Snatchers, right, or Body Snatchers or any of those or whatever. So if you want to go check it out and watch it yourself before we talk about it, that's where you're gonna find it. And it is starring Boris Karloff, so that's really the big,
there's your key.
There's the key right there. So, again, thanks, Jeff, for commenting, and Floyd for sending the letter. Really appreciate it. Anybody else, you know how to find us. Until we talk to you in a couple weeks. Bye.